This is part two of the Cycling Podcast episode this week, and it focuses on the impact of the coronavirus on both Italy and professional cycling as a whole, with interviews with Marco Pinotti, the head of performance at CCC, and the team boss at EF Pro Cycling, Jonathan Vauters.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
I suppose this is a podcast in two halves, which may well be how we do things during this period. We want to keep talking about cycling, keep talking about racing, while also dealing with the effects of the coronavirus as it impacts on professional cycling. So in this part, we're going to hear from a couple of people on that. This is I suppose part two of what is a very long podcast this week, and I'm not sure that it will be this long every week.
No,
but we thought we would.
No,
we would.
Well,
do that
we're adjusting to the new normal as well, aren't we? And I think probably it's just smart to quarantine the coronavirus conversation. So, you know, there will be people who want to avoid the, you know, are looking to listen to something that takes them away from the ongoing crisis, and quite understandably so. I'm kind of the same. I seek to limit how much of it I delve into, and so yeah, if the coronavirus crisis and its effect on professional cycling is not something that interests you at the moment, then this is kind of the point, I guess, to drop out, and we'll see you again next week from our isolated separate locations. But and I think the thing about it all is the uncertainty, isn't it? And whilst I completely get that people are very keen to try to sketch out when cycling might resume, what the end of season calendar might look like, I'm also, you know, maybe it's my the fact that I'm so averse to speculation, but I'm not finding that terribly helpful at the moment, the idea that it's all going to resume on a particular date. I'd rather not contemplate that at the moment, because that to me is easier to deal with than thinking that something might resume in June and then finding when we get to mid-May that gets pushed back. Personally, I would find that harder to deal with, but I do understand why people are drawing up kind of fantasy race calendars for the second half of the year. And obviously, it goes without saying, I hope that we all get through this as best as we possibly can, and that there is something to enjoy as soon as possible. But I do question the sort of the wisdom, and I wonder, Daniel, whether you've got any insight on this. The story coming out from it was Le Parisien in France, wasn't it, about the possibility of the Tour de France going ahead on its scheduled dates, starting in late June, and being run without a publicity caravan, without spectators. I mean, personally, that seems almost so unlikely as to be a complete non-starter. But I don't know whether you've looked into that at all.
I haven't got too much insight on that, Lionel, but it did strike me, and I spoke last week about Paris-Nice and this sort of behind closed doors edition of Paris-Nice that I ended up covering, and it did strike me that in the same way the Dauphiné is often used to sort of trial run things that will happen in the Tour de France, whether it's that coming edition of the Tour de France or in future years. So often they'll go to climbs which they're thinking of one day using the Tour, and so on and so forth. It did strike me that without that being their intention at the time during Paris-Nice, it might end up of being a bit of a sort of trial for certain things that they might want to implement at the Tour de France. So, for example, keeping fans out of the starts and finishes. They've probably learned some lessons from that. The problem, of course, is that the dimensions of the Tour de France absolutely dwarf Paris-Nice. And even if you have, for example, if we just look at the media aspect of it, even if it's sort of skeleton crews, very limited number of journalists allowed, it's still going to be many multiples of the number of journalists who were at Paris-Nice, for example.
I wonder at the point of that sort of behind closed doors Tour de France, when the whole point of the Tour de France is the show, isn't it?
Well,
it's the spectacle.
And Christian Prudhomme Guillaume's favourite sort of tagline for the Tour de France is 3,500 kilometres of smiles. That's what he always says.
Yeah.
So I think he would balk slightly at the idea of having to stage a Tour de France of that
without
nature.
Without fans, what is the point, really? I know, you know, there are plenty of races that people don't flock to the roadside to watch, and we enjoy them as just a sporting contest. But I really think that whilst I understand the eagerness to get back to something approaching normal, we also have to be careful we don't forget what the point of all this is, which is, the Tour de France is to join up the country and bring people out of their houses to celebrate the show. And without that, it loses more than just, you know, the spectacle of the fans being on the roadside for us watching on TV, or for people watching on TV. It loses its whole heartbeat and essence, I would say.
I imagine that the Giro and the Vuelta in particular will both be very nervous about any shortened version as well, as a possible precedent for the future. Yeah. I noticed Matteo Trentin this morning on Twitter calling for a one grand tour encompassing Italy, France and Spain.
I think it's a fantastic idea from a symbolic point of view. Particularly,
it would be great.
You know, I talked about the possible symbolism that the RCS, the Giro organisers, have got in mind of starting a Giro on the day of the national holiday. But, you know, a grand tour that maybe visited some of the areas that have been worst hit by the coronavirus crisis. I mean, it'd be fantastic. How feasible, how practical it is, I don't know.
The other thing is, I mean, we don't know how long this is going to go on. We know that the riders are going to carry on training. If you listen to Mitch Docker talking to Kevin Poulton about the effectiveness of getting a lot of work done on an indoor trainer in a relatively short amount of time, there is still an athletic consideration here as well. Can riders go from sort of indoor isolation, okay, they're going to be fit, but will they have replicated the workload to come out and do a 2 or 3 week stage race with all of that it entails, the sort of the breakdown of the immune system and the travel and everything? It might be that from an athletic point of view, returning with 3 week stage races just isn't practical this year. Again, I'm speculating.
I do love the idea of Thibaut Pinot spending the next few months fishing and looking after his goats and maybe doing the odd 40-minute session on the turbo trainer. Not a smart trainer, old school turbo trainer, or rollers. And then rocking up at the start of the Tour de France. I do quite like that idea.
What colour would the leader's jersey be, though? It would look like a sort of Neapolitan ice cream. Bit of pink, bit of yellow, bit of red.
Oh, for the Grand Tour, yeah. It'd look really nice.
I want to see Thibaut Pinot using rollers that he's fashioned out of 4 wine bottles. I don't know if that's possible, but if any listeners
wouldn't they topple over
devised that, well, I don't know.
We've got to be responsible. We can't recommend people try and do roller riding on wine bottles at the moment.
Don't do that at home.
Well, Daniel, you mentioned the idea of the Grand Tours visiting areas worst hit by the coronavirus. One of those places is Bergamo in northern Italy. Bergamo, of course, often the Finnish town for Il Lombardia, the home of Polenta as well. The Giro had a stage finish there a few years ago, which I think, did Bob Jungels win that day, Daniel? We were both there, weren't we? Yeah. And Marco Pinotti, former Italian time trial champion and CCC's time trial coach, a bit more than just a time trial coach.
Head of performance,
there we are. He is a native of Bergamo, isn't he? That's his hometown. And Daniel, you spoke to him this week.
So I live actually 10 kilometers south of Bergamo. And so Bergamo, the province, Bergamo is a town maybe of under 20,000 people. And the province around has been considered since the 60s like a hotbed of cycling. So Gimondi is maybe the most famous name coming from the area, and then from the 60s been a lot of riders, but also a lot of factories and bike manufacturers come from here, know, Colnago is just outside the province, Milano. You have De Rosa, and we have also Bianchi, Vittoria, all names, familiar brands that are still very popular in cycling. And in the 90s, in the early 2000s, this area had the highest amount of professional bike rider, all concentrated here, around 30 at that time. Now, you know, as the crisis of cycling hit a little bit Italy, Bergamo was affected as well. But it's still a passion, and it's still widespread here in the province. Not only professional bike rider, but a lot of people go by bike every Sunday here, despite the traffic.
And you talked about that period when it was really the sort of center of the cycling universe. I mean, give me some names in that period. I mean, the period when you were turning pro and just before. I mean, who were some of the people?
In the 90s, we had Savoldelli, who won two Giro d'Italia, Gotti. So Savoldelli was coming from Valle Seriana. So Bergamo basically is the capital of the province. Then you have two main valleys going up to the north. One is Valle Seriana, and was Savoldelli coming from this area. The other one is Valle Brembana, and Gotti is coming from this area. So then you have other riders.
Tonkov, you have to mention Tonkov.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's not only rider coming from the era, but we imported rider like Tonkov was coming here. Celestino was here. He's from Liguria, but he used to be based here. And a lot of under 23, the riders came from under 23 to here. Fabio Aru is one of these, and because he was racing for an amateur team based in the province of Bergamo. And many names, Aru, and then we have every type of rider from the gregario type of rider like Lanfranchi to the Milesi, for every type of races, especially stage races. Like as you said, the main names are Gotti, Savoldelli, the names that are here.
And Marco, just. I mean, it's a very beautiful place. You know, it's about an hour from Milan, so people will have heard, well, they'll know about Lombardy from the Tour of Lombardy, but they'll also have heard about the region of Lombardy being particularly struck by coronavirus. But just also tell people about the setting of Bergamo. It's a city almost on two levels. There's an old town, a high town, and a town lower down, and also it sort of backs onto the foothills of the Alps, doesn't it?
Yeah, except the foothills of the pre-Alps, because there are two type of chains. You know, the famous one is the Alps, but it's really the north. It's like a chain around the north of Italy. But then there is this another small chain which is called pre-Alps. It goes from Como to Brescia, and basically this is much nicer to go by because it's not so high in terms of altitude. It goes maybe up to 2,000, but really, really the peak where you only have to go to hike there. But the hills to go for cycling is maybe 1,200 meters, 1,000 meters. So you can do pretty much in every time of the year, maybe only in December or January when it's cold. But so it's a very good place for cycling.
And another couple of small things, Marco, about Bergamo. I always think... the Bergamo accent is quite particular. It almost sounds to me as though you speak Italian with a Scottish accent. And then on the podcast, we always talk about food as well. And it's famous for, polenta. And the sweet version of polenta, which is polenta e osei, which is polenta and little birds, I suppose. But
Yeah, these are traditional. Because Bergamo has been considered before World War II, a very poor area, so very rural area, and the people were to be considered narrow-minded, meaning they were coming either from the mountain or just from the flat, where they working on corn. So they basically the meal they didn't have meat. No, the poor people didn't eat meat. They just eat corn-based meal like polenta and osei, which is birds. So basically, they were eating what they had, and still, so even after World War II, Bergamo became famous also in Milan because a lot of people working in the buildings, or famous muratori, they've been considered the one who beat Milano after World War II, because you have a lot of small track going down at 5 o'clock in the morning to Milan to work as muratore, so work to build the walls and the bricks, brick after brick, and all the palaces, all the buildings in Milan. So it's not considered a very a land of people with so intelligent but very hard worker.
And very, very beautiful as well. The old town, so it's almost
As you said before, Bergamo is maybe there is two parts. One is called Bergamo Alta, so which is the high town, which is really the it's a small jewel in Italy, as it's been is the old part of the city, which has been built during basically it's surrounded by a wall built by the Venetian Repubblica di Venezia in the you know, it took 300 years to build, but they finished basically in the 17th century. And but the town developed themselves with services and production and manufacturing just in the flat part around Bergamo. But the old part, the upper town, Bergamo Alta, and never changed. It's still medieval, very medieval, and there's a lot of churches. It's a very religious town. So there are a lot of monuments, a lot of nice places to visit. So we've been exploding in tourism in the last 20 years when what was supposed to be a small airport really became bigger and bigger. Orio al Serio is just only 5K out of the town. So up to a month ago, if you go to Bergamo Alta, half of the people were speaking foreign languages. So a lot of tourists, yeah.
And then about a month ago, so it was actually in terms of sport, the last few months have been great months for the city of Bergamo, because the football team Atalanta has been doing really, really well in the last couple of years. And on the 19th of February, there was this game in Atalanta. We're playing Valencia in the San Siro in Milan, because I guess the stadium in Bergamo is not big enough for those games. And we don't want to speculate about, you know, what happened that night, but it was sort of when this coronavirus situation was already starting to escalate. But a couple of days after that, we started to get the first cases of the coronavirus in Bergamo. And, you know, I've seen it, people who are working, you know, in the hospitals, they've speculatively linked the two things, all these Bergamo Atalanta fans going to Milan and to this football match and then coming back. But what we do know for sure is that, well, a bomb was set off sort of around the 20th of February, Marco, wasn't it? And you were in the UAE at that point with your team, CCC.
Yeah, I think you pointed out a good point, because so the night before the football game was the 19th, and it was a Wednesday. And I left the following day to Milan airport at 4 o'clock, because we had a flight to go first to Brussels and then to UAE. And nobody knew anything about this on Wednesday night, because we had 42,000 people going from Belgium, because the football game was played in San Siro in Milan, because I think for some rule of the Champions League, you have to a certain amount of the stadium need to be a certain size. So Atalanta in the home games has always been playing in San Siro. So we have as you said, it's 1 hour from Bergamo. So 40,000 or more people went to this stadium in San Siro, and maybe 2,000 or 3,000 came from Spain to the supporter of Valencia. And they have the highest, they have the highest ever recorded number of people following a home game of Atalanta in all history. But there were no restriction at all. And I left we knew about this coronavirus, what was supposed to be an epidemia back then, but was restricted to China. And when I left to the airport in the morning, I took with me extra gels with alcohol-based gel, because I said, okay, I'm going to Dubai. I know it's a cross point, so it better be more careful than I always have been, because I'm going in another place. But I think the problem was still considered outside. When I arrived, basically, it took 24 hours to arrive in Dubai, and I woke up on Friday morning. And Back then, there came the news, so it was a bit 2 days later, that they found the first positive in Italy, and was in Codogno, which is a little bit south of Milan, so a little bit more distant than Bergamo. And then a few hours, maybe 12 or 15 hours later, Saturday morning, came out the news that a few cases were coming from Bergamo. And it didn't seem, I was in the UAE, so I was far away, quite distant from the big noise. It didn't seem quite a big thing, but I remember the first thing I thought, I said, oh, either this is nothing, or if there is already something going around, this would be a bomb that will explode. Because I said, a lot of people came to the stadium that night, just 2 days before. So if this virus was already around, as I thought it could have been easily been, it would be a bomb, because 40,000 people, they could spread this the between themselves. And okay, I'm not saying that these games, but for sure this proximity of people in a lot of people, such in a small place, I think helped to let this bomb explode.
And you were obviously, you were talking to your wife and your son, who were, I guess, back in Bergamo. I mean, over the next sort of few days, what were they telling you about what was happening there?
Yeah, basically, it was nothing, you know. They were worried because my wife's mother is in Nembro. So Nembro is the town where a famous climb, Silvino, starts.
Yeah.
And 1 or 2 days later, maybe 23 or 24 February, back then it was like 10, 12, 20, and then 25, 30, people were found, they heard on the news that they were found positive for this coronavirus. And so there was kind of a kind of focolaio, I don't know, you know.
Focal point.
A focal point, yeah. One was in Codogno, the other one seems to be around Alzano and Nembro. And then later turned out that this virus basically started to spread in a hospital. So because, I don't know, some people were carrying the virus and they were sick, they've been visiting the hospital first in Codogno and then another one in Alzano. And probably they have not been treated as so contagious in the beginning. So the first 2 days that those people have been there with their parents and in the hospital, they have been contaminating other people. And then from then that's where it all started. I think that's why Valle Seriana, because this hospital in Alzano is just 1 kilometer from Nembro, that it started there in Valle Seriana. But this was probably before the football game, so 1 or 2 days before. We're just talking about mid-February.
Yeah.
And that is why I think it started spreading and this focal point around Bergamo, which became worse than the one in Codogno, because Codogno was recognized immediately as the red area. But I'm in Bergamo, my wife told me, the kids are staying home to school. She's working in a swimming pool, but the swimming pool, we are closing the swimming pool, but it was... we have been advised to wash the hand, but for the first week, we're just closing the school 1 week and strict measure in all Lombardia, but the red zone was just for 10 or 11 villages. The rest was just considered like an orange zone, like a critical area that you have to work from home if you can and try to avoid close contact to people, keep 2 meters. But for example, restaurant was still open at lunchtime, bar was still open at lunchtime. So it was a kind of, nobody realized it a little bit, what was the problem. So I remember one thing, that the doctor, when I arrived in Dubai, the doctor said that the health department of Dubai asked people coming from Lombardia, like me, to point out if I had some signals, fever or any coughing or anything, because then we would need to be quarantined immediately. So I think that's why how those two people were coming probably from this area, and they start seeing it, and they test them, and they found them positive. So they tested during the night, some journalists the day after. So basically we were put in quarantine in the hotel we were for 2 days, and until we get the results of the test on Saturday. And then there was not a clear communication, but anyway, Saturday night they say, okay, whoever is the team completely out of with no positive test can leave. And so we were just able to, I remember we didn't sleep on Sunday because we have to organize to pack everything. And we left. I left the hotel the first because I had to take care of this of the all the material going first to Düsseldorf. And we left at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday from UAE. I went to Düsseldorf, and then this travel, I was already considering myself like I was potential. Even if I test positive negative, I considered myself to be potentially contagious. So I was carrying a mask, trying to not to touch anything or not to stay around from people. And then I came home and I found home was still, I was curious on one side because the country area I was living was like half and half. There was maybe 50% or 40% less of traffic. I came home from the airport. Okay, you could see there was nobody at the airport considered to normal time. But the economy was still going a little bit. School were off, so I came home. I said, okay, it's better if I stay at home until March 10 or 12. So at least I'm 2 weeks off the last time I was possible in contact with some people from who got the coronavirus. But and then you know. This measure, the strict measure lockdown came to this region on March 8th. March 8th became a really strict measure. And then first in Lombardia and then from March 11th to all Italy.
So chaps, that was Marco telling us well about the sort of early stages of the coronavirus outbreak from his point of view when he was in the UAE and then coming back to Bergamo. And then since then, he and the sort of town have been engulfed by this awful situation where it really has become, well, it's no exaggeration to say that it's become the epicenter in the world of the coronavirus crisis. But you've also at the same time got this, well, Marco is in a paradoxical situation where he doesn't really feel any more connected to it than we do, because he's shut away with his family in his home, and he knows a few people who have been affected by it, but otherwise everything he knows about what's sort of happening in the houses, you know, around his own, he's finding out from the local newspaper.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWaka, flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWaka. If you run a business, find out more at iwoka.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk.
My name is James Turner. I am the IT manager at iWoka. Super passionate about everything to do with bicycles. Been sort of following the industry and racing and taking part in racing for as long as I can remember, and it's something that helps me keep very much sane and occupied in my downtime. I love the fact that iWaka does get involved in not just sort of straight business activities, and iWaka as a company, we see ourselves very much as an enabler for other small businesses. And so I do see the sort of the sporting angle of things being an enabler to society, if you will, as very much more sort of just an extension on that mission, if you will. We do have on staff quite a few talented athletes from many different sports, but personally, sort of being very involved in cycling myself, selfishly, I really enjoyed that sort of announcement. It was great for me to hear out of the blue from my friends in the marketing department that they were thinking of getting involved initially with cycling, and then seeing the additional activities that have come out of the department has been it's just fantastic.
Well, mention of the football stadium there, Daniel, just reminds me of the newspaper article from the Italian press that you drew my attention to on Twitter this week. The lead doctor at the main hospital in Bergamo talking was asked why Bergamo was being so badly affected, and he said in his opinion it was the fact that so many people from Bergamo went to Milan to watch their team Atalanta play in the Champions League, because Atalanta are not able to play their Champions League matches at their home ground because it's not, doesn't meet UEFA's requirements. So they've been playing their home matches in Milan at the San Siro Stadium, and 40,000 spectators made their journey to Milan and then travelled back on trains, coaches, in cars, and possibly picked up the virus there. And that kind of, you know, that kind of shows, it showed me anyway, the impact of something as kind of benign as a sporting event on, you know, on a virus, and unwittingly, unknowingly fanning the flames of this crisis.
Well, you're right, Lionel, and the flames have been fanned, and unfortunately continue to be fanned in Bergamo. And I talked a bit more to Marco about that, and also the sort of resonance that this crisis and what's happening in Bergamo has now got, not just in Italy but worldwide.
When they first started the first measure, I was not here, I was in UAE, but I remember even back from there, and it seemed like a very extreme measure, closing everything down, and people were worried, and so there was some panic, and a lot of people, like not normal people, but like politicians or league, what are supposed to be leader of the country, they start this hashtag, oh, Milano riparte, we don't stop, we just stop, blah, blah, blah. So say, oh, life is still going on. Why are you all closing yourself down in the house? And so, yeah, if you're not, you know, they stop doing the test all over the people. We do the test only on people who have some symptoms. And that has been probably a week where there was a leeway. They give leeway to this virus, and then until Saturday 7, they start. Okay, no, we block everything. But before blocking everything, there has been like a leaking of information of this. So we have maybe, I don't know, 20,000 people trying to leave Lombardy to their home places in south of Italy or other places, and that we are paying now. So the numbers we've seen increasing, I think, are results of those poor management of the situation about 15 days ago. I have to say, from March 8th, maybe March 9th, at least the area where I live is being really, really locked down. You could go, you go out, you see only people who need to go out just to buy food or need to go to work. And there has been a lot of, people, it seems like there is radioactivity in the air. So everybody's scared of everybody since then. And I think the results of this we will see in the next couple of days, where the number will start going down, at least in the area I live, at least in the area I live.
Marco, I mean, now you're in the same situation as a lot of people across Europe. You're basically, you shut away in your own home with your family. So I imagine that your sort of exposure to everything that's going on in Bergamo is limited to, you know, the same sort of reports and things that we're seeing in the media. I mean, on Bergamo specifically, I think people internationally will have seen there was a video that went round of L'Eco di Bergamo, which is the local newspaper, someone opening it up on a typical day and seeing the sort of death notices, and then comparing that to a day a couple of weeks ago where there was 10 pages of death notices, and then films of army vehicles, army lorries transporting dead bodies to the crematorium. And I think, you know, last week there were 300 deaths in the province of Bergamo, supposedly from COVID-19. So the situation is pretty grim.
Yes, exactly. I mean, L'Eco di Bergamo, you know, these images of the pages of people death in L'Eco di Bergamo, is that, you know, I have a subscription to the newspaper, so every day I noticed immediately from beginning of March there was this type of the amount of pages were going on, and but the numbers, as you said, the official number of death from this disease are much low. Is that the tip of, I think they are just the tip of the iceberg, because I don't have news here apart from the newspaper, but the newspaper itself published yesterday some number of some villages that show another picture, maybe a more dreadful pictures because, for example, in Embro, there have been 100, only in Embro, 120 people death in the first 19 days of March compared to 14 last year. And Caravaggio, another town, you know, name of the...
The painter.
The painter, yeah, has 50 death. And only two of those are officially for the coronavirus. And last year they had 6 death in the same period. Damine, 70. Last year, only 18. So I think there has been, in general, 4 to 5, on average, people, 4 or 5 times number of deaths compared to last year. And in some places, maybe 10 times more, like Alzano, neighbor, which was the would have been the most hit part. And of course, you know, the image, I think the image of the deaf people being taken by the military lorries to be cremated.
Correct.
And, in other countries, because the crematory of Bergamo cannot handle those anymore. They can only do maybe, I think, 50 a day. I think it's shocking, but it was necessary, because then the people really start to do what they have to do, which is stay at home and use as much as possible contact, social contacts with other people. And I think this will be, I hope it would be a lesson or a mistake not to be done by other countries.
And Marco, you've told me your family is fine and your friends, you aren't sort of as personally affected by it as some people in Bergamo, but I guess everyone in Bergamo knows someone who is very much affected by it.
Yeah. I know a friend of a friend who have 6 or 7 or 10 people dying, and especially is the generation that built this country after World War II. So they were quite active people in voluntary stuff or in business or in the church. So we are losing a little this generation. I would say, okay, it's old people that are caring a big a lot. It's a patrimonio from us.
It's part of your heritage. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of heritage. These people. So, and it's not nice a way to die, because they when a person is called by when someone call an ambulance and they take this person to an ambulance, they bring him to the hospital. Lucky if they still can bring it to the hospital, because now the hospital are overcrowded. They say then goodbye. Maybe they don't see them for 10 days, and then they receive a phone call. Oh, your whatever, death, mom, died. And you cannot visit them anymore. There's no funeral. So they just one person go there. So cemetery is closed. So it's a very traumatic situation from every point of view for the people affected by this. And I'm at home, I'm quite distant of this, but if you think about this, even the church is as closed now. In the first week you could go to church, there were no ceremony, but the churches are closed. So it's I can tell you, this is a very religious land, at least in Bergamo here. So they are trying to, we can still do the mass via Facebook or Instagram, but that's not quite the same thing, at least not for me.
And Marco, you're at home. You're trying to stay safe with your family. You told me you're reading a very famous, one of the most famous Italian books, and it is at least partly about a plague as well. So the book is I Promessi Sposi, which is the betrothed in English. And so you're doing that, and then you're also thinking about your work as well, and the team and how to manage the CCC team. And you know, riders training and so on.
Yeah. I start reading again this book, because this is a book that is studied in all high school of Italy, most of them. It's a popular historical romance, and it tells the story of these two people. Which has, actually, this book is takes the story that this book are taking place in Milan, Bergamo, Lecco. This is also not far from here, and it's written in it's taking place in the 17th century, where there has been a very big pandemic with plague, la peste, and you know this plague hits Milan and the countries, and there is the writer tell the story that when this plague happens, the people, so it's like an invisible enemy, like this virus, and the people needed to find an enemy, a visible enemy, so to point the finger to this one, it's your fault that you're spreading the virus around, and this is pretty much what has been happening last week, because last week or the last 10 days in the region I live, because when the government started the lockdown, one of the things that was written in the decree, in the decreto, was like, okay, you can still do physical activities, but you need to do individually. So, for example, and so they were really saying, especially for bike riding, because you know, this is a podcast about cycling, you should not go by bike, not because it's dangerous to spread the virus, but because if you get hurt, you had a crash, and you go to hospital, the two options. One, you don't get taken care of because there are other stuff to do, too many. And two, if they take care of you, you're going to get the coronavirus because it's a very contaminated area. So, but basically, I said, don't go out because if you crash, you are still you are affecting a part of an emergency room, which is already. So it's better stay home. But professional bike rider, they were allowed to go because it's part of their job. And to be honest, there's no car around. So it's quite safe, unless you do stupid things. It's quite safe to go by bike. But and then you have runners, you know, maybe recreational people that just want to go for a walk, just to go for break. To take some fresh air out of the lockdown, and there has been a lot of people from the terraces like insulting them, complaining with them. I had a few riders that live in Bergamo that I followed. They said, oh, I'm not going back. They're professional bike riders, so they are allowed to go because it's part of their job to keep themselves fit and train. And as far as I can understand, this is not the priority now. But they have been insulted, they have been harassed by other people on the road just because they were doing their job. So nobody was defending them. And now, from 2 days ago, it's forbidden any physical activity in Italy. It's okay to respect the rule, but what I'm saying, I know there are priority, but it's not fair to find an enemy because it's not because of people who go for a run by themselves that we have this problem. So right now with the situation, we have riders in the team coming here, so we have been switched, trying to keep them motivated and fit in a very uncertain situation for them, for the team, because we don't know how the calendar is going to be in the next month. And we try to do everything with basically going back to base level, to a sort of base period. And they do training most of the time indoors. So we're trying to organize. We have 28 riders in the team. Some of them are still allowed to go in their countries. They are maybe in Germany, Belgium, or but the riders who are in Spain and Italy, and I think also France, they cannot go. And so we made sure that everybody has a good trainer. And so they will organize a training plan around the indoor session.
And I guess over the last week or so, it's got simpler in a way, because a couple of weeks ago, it might have seemed as though it was possible that there would be racing again in May or June or whatever. But as soon as you've realised that there would be no classics, there would be no Giro, then I think most riders are pretty much doing the same thing, which is almost what they would be doing in the first month of their winter break. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, because it was. It's better to know that there are no races that don't assume maybe there will be races. Because when we had, during Paris Tirreno, which is coming down from UAE, we had a lot of discussion, a lot of time spent in trying to plan and then plan again and then change. based on, oh, maybe they do Paris-Nice, maybe they do Tirreno, maybe they do Catalunya, maybe they don't do it. And for example, we decided as a team, because under the doctor, the medical department of the team told us, no, you should not go to Paris because you are going to increase the risk to carry the virus around. And I think it was a good decision. It was not easy to be accepted by the rider because the rider wanted to go on a camp. They wanted to go to the race. So alternatively, you say, okay, maybe we try to organize a camp in a place which is not affected or which we thought we could not be affected yet. And we sent six riders to Sierra Nevada. But after 6-7 days, as we saw, the plan was supposed to last longer. Everybody came back home because when we saw that there were dangers of the numbers were increasing as well in Spain, we advised them to come back home. And so we stopped. We finished the camp, and now at least we know. We don't know when the races will start. If the races will start this year again. But yeah, I don't see any race happening until the month of June at least.
And Marco, I mean, this is obviously an almost exclusively negative situation for everyone for lots of reasons, economic and, you know, and health and emotional. But, you know, there are some people or you know, we're all to a certain extent discovering maybe crumbs of comfort, small sort of positives, whether it be, you know, the pace of life kind of slowing down or the possibility to kind of reassess things. I mean, has anything like that crossed your mind, maybe sort of professionally over the past couple of weeks, things that maybe things to do with the team, maybe different things that you'll do in the future or just in life in general?
Yeah, I think I'm still in the phase you have a lot of time to think. And as you said, there are some good things about this situation. Especially, I don't know, for those who have families, because it gives you priority in life. I know I never spent so much time with my kids, you know, like in the past 2 weeks. And it's nice from this point of view, but on the other side, you understand how things can turn around quickly. So I'm always trying to be positive, and I think this situation it's basically a war. From my generation of a younger generation, the war that we didn't live, and after World War II, I think there has been European Union came out, a lot of good things came out. So I think from this this moment, however long it will be, we are able to rebuild ourselves and rebuild the model of the society in a way that we'll be able to handle this situation in a better way in the future, and we'll make a stronger community with more. The distance we are living now, that we are forced to keep with people, I think we have a rebound effect when everything will be over. So, yeah, after, you know, in a during as a background, you learn after the uphill path, there's a plateau, okay, long, up and down, but then all of us, sooner or later, they stand the same. So I think it will be the same with this situation. And I'm saying this expecting that the months coming will be much worse than what we are doing now. Because now we are doing, you know, the people in the hospital are carrying the higher load. All of physicians, nurses are really at the front of the war. But when the hospital will start to be more in balance with the situation with diseased people, then the hard part will come to normal people, because then the economy will pay for this lockdown, and then you will have bigger, much bigger problem. Then I'm not saying this problem is small, but now it's not when the gross domestic product of the country goes down 20%, it's not that 1,000 people die, maybe a million people have problem, families, so you will have other social. So the hardest part is still to come, but I think still in the end, we will be able as a human being to come back more united and stronger. So, and able to deal with this the challenges of the 21st century.
So after the social distancing, social riavvicinamento.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So, chaps, that was sort of Marco finishing on, he hoped and we hoped a brighter note, talking about the sort of positive things that generally come from, desperate situations and, even mentioning there the Second World War and how sort of Europe came together after that. And, we can only hope that applies sort of in cycling and obviously on a wider level, as regards humanity at large.
And Bergamo, a place we know so well, don't we, from numerous visits. I was there for Il Lombardia in October, and we were just on the outskirts of Bergamo at the Giro last year. It was the day that you left the Giro, actually, Lionel. And Daniel, you and I, on a very rainy day, drove to a couple of team hotels, including CCC, actually. But you mentioned that the suburb that we're going through, I think, does Marco live on the outskirts of Bergamo? Because you mentioned one of the suburbs of Bergamo in that night's podcast, and Marco actually got in touch just to correct you a little bit your characterization of it.
Yeah, Zingonia, which is a place which I suppose you would compare. You might compare. I'm probably going to insult Zingonia and Marco again now, but you might compare to sort of Moss Side in Manchester, in the sense that it's got a bit of a notorious reputation the last few years.
Well done. You've insulted the people of Moss Side as well.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, dear. It is an incredible part of the world. And I just, I hope we can get there again soon. And I hope that Bergamo, it was nice to hear from Marco and hope he and people in Bergamo are going to emerge from this sooner rather than later.
We'll hopefully, Rich, one day, not too far from now, be enjoying some lovely polenta and wild boar cinghiale. There's a great restaurant up in the high town in Bergamo Alta, called Da Mimmo. There are a lot of good restaurants up there. My favourite is called Da Mimmo, and they do fantastic polenta e cinghiale and wild boar.
I'll be having the vegetarian wild boar with my polenta. We stayed in a delightful little guest house near the centre of Bergamo when we were there a couple of years ago, Daniel. I went back there actually for a little holiday. It's a beautiful city. I urge people to go when Italy begins to open up again.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
My name's Chris Hoy. I'm a six-time Olympic gold medalist and an 11-time world champion. 92, it was very basic indeed. Basically, maltodextrin, using carbohydrate mixed up with water. That was your fuel source for endurance rides and for sort of recovery after our sessions. Protein for sprinters. So the endurance riders wouldn't use protein because they thought that if you had a scoop of protein, you were going to get muscles like Arnold Schwarzenegger. But then creatine came out. So 1992, creatine came out. That was a new super wonder product, again, for power athletes as opposed to endurance athletes. And Science and Sport were one of the first companies to produce this creatine monohydrate. So, yeah, it was expensive. It was about 20 quid a tub back then. And that, as a student, that was a lot of money. But, we decided, this is a product worth using. So, Science and Sport has been a company I've used, trusted, since then, and even in my retirement now, I still use their products. And I think when you become an ambassador for a company, you only do it if you truly believe in what the company stands for and the products, and I certainly do with Science and Sport.
Now, you also spoke, Lionel, to Jonathan Vauters of EF Pro Cycling.
Yeah, I did. Thinking ahead and speculating on how professional cycling will emerge from this is, it's a it's a strange one, isn't it? Because as we keep saying, and I do feel I need to sort of caveat this conversation slightly, because on the one hand, you know, considering what else is going on and how devastating the coronavirus is turning out to be, professional cycling, you know, doesn't really matter, and yet it does. It's at people's livelihoods as well as a source of great entertainment and enjoyment for people. But I spoke to Jonathan Voorters about the great unanswerable question at the moment, which is how well equipped is professional cycling, the races, the teams, in particular, to cope with basically what could be a 3, 4, 5, 6 month layoff. I know you've kind of talked about this a bit, but just talk me through your own kind of journey coming to terms with what this virus was going to mean. Because in the week before Strada Bianca, you were kind of quite keen for business to go on as usual. And by the end of the week, you were one of the first people within professional cycling to really say, look, I think this is... you know, it's irresponsible to press ahead, and you were, well, I think the first team to actually pull out of Strada Bianca.
Yeah, we were. I mean, it was a big change in mindset for me, honestly. You know, it's funny because it was Monday that week, and I woke up and saw the news that RCS was planning on pushing ahead. You know, Strada Bianchi and Tirreno and Milan Sanremo. And, you know, and then so I put something out on Twitter that was a fairly bullish sounding, like, okay, we've got to press ahead. And, you know, this is life and have to move on. And I'd put a tweet out maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 days, maybe a week before that, that said, you know, the real epidemic in our modern world is the denial that we all are going to eventually die, which is, you know, that's a rather philosophical statement. And fundamentally, actually, I still stick with that statement, and that, you know, I do think that we grow up in a world where somehow, like, death is just sort of shuffled off to the side, and we're all made to think that it just never really happens and it's never really in front of us. And okay, someone's 97-year-old grandma dies once in a while, but it's nothing, you know, it's not in our face like it has been in previous generations. You know, in previous generations, death was a very real and consistent and visible thing. You know, World War II, World War One, Spanish flu, going back into the 1800s, where, you know, I mean, medical care was essentially, I mean, not non-existent, but at a much lower level of technology, where very simple things could kill people. And we've sort of arrived at a point where, you know, that's not true. But anyway, so going back to Tirreno and Strada Bianchi, is I put out a really bullish statement. And, you know, and a bunch of people liked it. And then there were a few comments that were very negative. But there was one comment from a doctor on my timeline that I read, and she just said, listen, this isn't about not being bullish about the future, and this isn't about people not getting on with their lives, and this isn't about a denial of death, but it is about making sure that our medical systems aren't overloaded in a massive peak of cases. And so then I responded to her. And basically said, you know, could you explain more? And she did, and she kind of walked me through, you know, what we're seeing now, very all over the place, is, you know, flatten the peak. And I instantly understood what she was saying, and I instantly thought about it and said, ooh, that's actually really important. And then I started thinking not about the riders and the staff on my team and their health, because that's sort of like naturally like where your mind goes, and where our medical staff were like, are people safe? And we thought, well, yeah, for the most part, we have very healthy people. You know, even our staff are incredibly, you know, healthy. Like, I think this isn't a big deal for us. And then statistically, you're looking at it and saying, oh, these numbers statistically are just insignificant. But then I started thinking about the fundamentals of a bike race, which the fundamentals of a bike race are you're traveling from town to town with a crew of mechanics, with a crew of support staff, with the riders, and you're going from one hotel to the next hotel and interacting with the people at that hotel, and then going to the next hotel and interacting with people at that hotel. And then on the side of the road, you know, some little kid wants a water bottle, and then what he gives his water bottle to his grandma, and et cetera, et cetera. And I just started thinking through all those little like micro interactions that a bike race causes that otherwise wouldn't happen. And said to myself, you know, whoa, this is sort of almost like the perfect vector for this disease. Like Tirreno Adriatico would basically, you know, if just three or four people in the caravan of the peloton were positive, it would carry it not only throughout the peloton, but throughout central Italy. Because of this random doctor on Twitter, I think she's Portuguese. You'd have to look back and find her name, but I thought the whole thing through and just said, okay, like we can't be the vector, that exacerbates this situation and helps overload the Italian medical system. Now, of course it's already overloaded now, but I just didn't want to be a causative, factor in that. And that was our deciding point, which at that point in time, you know, a lot of the things that you would think were ridiculous at that point in time, it was a really hard decision to make because technically speaking, with our World Tour license, we can't skip those three races unilaterally and just say we're out. Your World Tour license would be revoked. We'd be kicked out of the World Tour. We couldn't do the Tour de France. I mean, the consequences at that moment when we made that decision and no other teams had come out and said, we're not going to these races either, was really pretty large, which is one of the reasons that we decided to just be fairly public about it, because we figured, well, you know, historically with the UCI, the only way the UCI makes a decision is if it's backed into a corner by the media. So I just thought, okay, well, if we're going to do this, then we're going to do this via the Wall Street Journal, because that'll push them into such a bad situation. They're going to have to allow, you know, other teams and ourselves to be able to recuse ourselves from these races without being kicked out of the World Tour. And that worked, as it historically has with the UCI, that the way you get them to act is to, you know, like I said, to back them into a corner via media.
Experience any sort of blowback on that? I mean, obviously now as we're talking a couple of weeks down the line, it was clearly the right decision, we can discuss the wisdom of Paris-Nice going on to almost its conclusion, but clearly it was the right decision. But at the time, did you have any dissenting voices from within the sport saying that this is an overreaction?
Not massively. Everyone was clearly, I think all the other teams were clearly ready to go, but they were fearing the same thing we were. So it was just, we were the straw that broke the camel's back, as it were. I think everyone was thinking the exact same thing. There wasn't really any blowback, no. It's so funny in the timeline of all this stuff. It's just crazy. It's like, had we done that 2 days earlier, there would have been, for sure. Had we done it 2 days earlier, there probably would have been as per rule 17.304-8, you know, your World Tour license will now be revoked, blah, 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 or something like that, right? Had we done it just a few days earlier. But by the time we did it, it was like the reaction was just sort of, okay, we understand you're making this decision. We'll keep you updated. I mean, it was very neutral. There wasn't really any significant blowback. It's funny that we're even discussing this, because right now it seems like, you know, I mean, hindsight is 2020, right? But just looking back 2 weeks, it's like, well, I mean, why would anyone kick you out of the World Tour for not wanting to do a bike race in Italy? I mean, it seems insane, right? But at that moment, you know, it was like a big step with like potentially huge consequences for the team.
And now sort of rolling on a couple of weeks, the postponements have wiped out the season up to the end of May. And I mean, I feel, and we feel on the podcast, it's kind of odd to look at this whole situation through the prism of a professional sport, because on the one hand, in the grand scheme of things, it really doesn't matter. And yet on the other hand, watching sport is one of life's pleasures. It's one of the things that brings people together and divides them occasionally. But, you know, it's something that people look forward to and enjoy. And that's the purpose for it, really, when all is said and done. But we're in a strange situation where the season is completely on hold. And although the postponements are extending to the end of May and in a couple of cases into June, we have no confidence in saying when the season might resume. And I suppose it's almost unseemly to speculate about that at this stage.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a funny thing. I was asked to write an op-ed for the New York Times during this time, and it was about, you know, the central theme of it. It never got published because basically, one, I just got too busy like evacuating all of our writers back to their homes and so on and so forth, and then two, it was sort of irrelevant by the time, you know, like by the time it was actually written, it was like the world had moved on. You know, I mean, I only wrote it in the space of 3 days, but it was already irrelevant by the time the world had moved on. And the premise of the op-ed was essentially, you know, as the world shuts down around it, you know, a lonely gray bike race in France sort of clumsily lumbers its way southward, meaning Paris-Nice. And the central premise was, you know, sort of along the lines of, yes, it's definitely our social responsibility to limit these and to you know, limit contact with other people and to flatten the peak. And I understand that. But yet the only thing at that point in time that I felt like the only reason I was waking up in the morning was to see if Sergio Higuita had made the front echelon in Paris-Nice, because there was absolutely zero good news in the rest of the world. I mean, nothing. There was nothing to be inspired by. There was nothing. It was just hammered by horrible news every single day. And so then you have this one spectatorless, very odd looking, lonely bike race, you know, in France. And, you know, it was just sort of an odd juxtaposition. Like, I mean, every morning we woke up and it was like, okay, should we pull the team out of Paris-Nice or, you know, should we let it go on one more day? And those decisions weren't necessarily easy. I mean, we were basing it on Department of State and CDC advisories and best information we had available for whether the areas we were in were actually at risk for the bike race to become a vector for the disease or not. And the decision would sort of end up barely being yes every single day. But anyway, in this op-ed, you know, it was just sort of that everyone in the world right now is obviously doing their best and fighting very hard to preserve life. And that's incredibly admirable. But, you know, sometimes I would get to a moment and say, you know, but we're preserving life. But are we preserving a life that's worth living? Like, if in a way that, like, if there's nothing of joy in the world, then what are we preserving? And I know, again, that's kind of a harsh way to look at it, but that was what was going through my mind as I was writing this op-ed about Paris-Nice. And it's just sort of an interesting thing as how I think bike racing, you can use it as a barometer as to how severe the world event is, because basically for 130 years now, bike races don't get canceled for anything. Like the only thing they get canceled for is world wars. And even in world wars, many of the monuments would continue to run during the world war. And that's just, you stop and think about that and go, wow. So this event is like, I mean, Paris-Roubaix was running in Nazi occupied France in World War II. I mean, it didn't run once, you know, D-Day had occurred in 1944, but like in 1942 and 1943, they were having a version of Paris-Roubaix. And so you think, you know, this is more significant than World War II if you're using the cancellation of bike races as the barometer. I mean, this is the most significant event of the 21st century by far. And then if you use the barometer of cancellations of bike races, which I know is not an exact barometer, of course, you could say this is one of the most, if not the most significant event for, you know, 100 years now.
So just talk me through, you mentioned there about evacuating your riders, making sure everyone got home. TJ Van Garderen left Paris-Nice pretty much once the US had announced that it was going to lock down on incoming flights from the Schengen area of Europe. I'm assuming that there was, you know, there was absolutely no discussion about that. And if any riders said, look, I'm not happy, I want to get home, that would have been absolutely fine.
Yeah. That's the option was always with the rider. Like, Paris Nice was one of those, you know, very democratic, like, do you guys all want to race? You know, yes or no. If anyone doesn't want to race, you know, no problem. Go home, be with your family. Like, we don't, you know, it's no issue. You know, do our doctors feel comfortable racing? Do the people on the ground? I mean, we put it down to it. What the final call as to whether we were racing or not was actually at the directors meeting live on the ground. And the final decision was given to the team doctor. You know, like, do you feel comfortable with the measures that ASO has put in place before we proceed? And so, you know, day by day, like, we came up with the answer, yes. And you know, when TJ finally said, okay, I got to get home because of this, that made perfect sense to us. And there was no problem, you know, with letting him do that. You know, interesting, like, Lawson Craddock, he wanted to stay in the race. And he made that decision. You know, it was an interesting, I don't know, it was an interesting week. I mean, one thing I will say is, you know, by Saturday, Paris Nice was the only sporting event going on in the entire world. And I don't know if, you know, I don't know if there was wisdom in that or not, but it was, you know, the progression of how quickly the world had moved in that week was pretty astounding to watch. And, you know, a lot of the guys, when Paris Nice was done, we barely got them repatriated into their home countries. I mean, it was not a simple process to just, you know, book them on the next flight and then off they go. Like, it was very hit or miss as to whether we were going to get everyone home and safe. And, you know, and even some of the guys who they decided they wanted to stay in Girona, I mean, now they're, you know, I mean, like, we have Tom Scully who's in Girona. I mean, maybe he's up in Andorra now. You know, I mean, he's from New Zealand. He's a long, long way from home, and it's probably going to be months and months and months before he can get back to New Zealand.
Yeah, Mitch Docker as well, who's obviously in Girona and in the same situation with family back in Australia. What are the kind of the short, medium, and slightly longer term implications for the sport, do you think? I mean, you know, we've got to be positive. Richard keeps saying, you know, we will get through this and things will get back to normal, but the longer there's a pause, I guess the more complicated it becomes to rescue everything and put it back together again.
You know, it's I mean, the implications of this are going to be very big for the sport. I don't know how exactly. I mean, on the positive side, I feel like this is a chance for the sport to really reinvent itself. You know, do we really need whatever, you know, 500 days of racing on the calendar? You know, is there not a way to make things more compact and more maneuverable and more centralized and, you know, the decision-making a little bit swifter? I mean, as you can see, like, with Tirreno and Strada Bianchi and that, like, the decision making was completely decentralized. Like, it was the teams just saying, we're not showing up. There was no guidance from the UCI whatsoever. It was just very much like to each his own, you know, every man for himself, abandon ship, whatever. Maybe this is a large enough event for us to sit back and to cause a little bit of reflection as to whether or not, that, you know, is really the way the sport should be. I think, you know, the economic impacts of this are going to be pretty big. I mean, that's globally, they're going to be enormous. We've only begun to see, it's just that the economic impacts, we've only seen the tip of the iceberg. And I think, you know, there's going to be a pause in looking at, you know, is it really that we, you know, need to have this many races? Do we need to have this many teams? It, you know, it's all good when times are good, but when times are bad, then it's, you know, does that not seem to sort of hurt the sport a little bit more than it otherwise could be? I mean, I guess there's an old expression of, you know, when the tide goes out, you get to see who was swimming naked. So I think that's gonna be the case in cycling, is that we're gonna look at a sport that has, you know, a completely broken business model, and has been for a long time, that's just been sort of surviving off of, you know, a momentum created by high net worth individuals and whatnot. But is that the right way forward? Is the business model that's underlying cycling, is that actually sustainable? And of course it's sustainable in good times, but a lot of things are sustainable in good times. And, you know, in something like this, I think this is going to put a severe pressure on that. And my hope would be is that there's going to be a real re-examining of the sport from a strategic level as to how to sort of reorganize it in a better way, you know, once things kind of start to move again.
In terms of cycling's business model, I mean, sports like soccer, the NBA, baseball, I mean, they have huge broadcasting contracts that the teams all benefit from, of course. And yeah, they also have stadium revenues, which, you know, yeah, ticket sales and hot, yeah, dogs and beer and what have you. Cycling doesn't have any of that, but of course it does have, I mean, obviously there is TV revenue, but it doesn't make its way through to the teams, other than through the prize money. But cycling obviously depends on the real world, doesn't it? The businesses that sponsor the teams and sponsor the events, yeah, are the health of those companies is going to be key to, you know, what we emerge with, I guess.
Yeah. No, I mean, without a doubt. And it's a very, if you look at that from the fact that 80% of, you know, cycling's revenue is sponsorship, and then you look at the you know, the teams in general right now and where those sponsors sort of come from, I mean, it's a, you know, again, like I hope it serves as a catalyst. And, you know, this is a 130-year-old sport that has survived through a lot of things. So, you know, I think we've got a proven track record of surviving when others have not. But with a critical eye, you know, you think, well, I don't know, you know, Quick Step, are people going to be remodeling their homes right now and buying new floors? Probably not. You know, the price of oil is at an all-time low. How's that going to affect, you know, some of the oil, you know, the oil money teams, fracking teams? You know, Astana has already not been paying their riders. You know, Sunweb, travel company, EF. You know, EF is one-third of their business pillar is based on international travel. So, you know, you look at that and go, I mean, across the board, I don't know, you know, Bora Hansgrohe, we can go down the list of the team, Bora Hansgrohe, like, are you going to remodel your kitchen and put in a new shower? Like, when, you know, when you're worried about whether or not you can get food for the next day, you know, fundamentally, you know, these companies, are going to hurt along with the rest of the world. I mean, this is, you know, that's the reason you can go down to any sponsor in cycling and say, "Ooh, that's, you know, that might be difficult. That's because any company in the world right now, outside of toilet paper manufacturers, are, you know, really going to suffer through this. And we don't have any toilet paper manufacturers in sponsorship of cycling. So loo paper, as you say.
What kind of conversations are going on, maybe between you and the sponsoring company and you and the staff, you and the riders, or staff and riders? I mean, what's the sense at the moment? Is it just everybody's, well, lots of people are at different stages of lockdown, of course, at the moment, but
yeah,
what's the talk at the moment?
I mean, our talk was first just logistically getting everything settled, getting everyone to where they need to be, and, you know, getting the team settled. And so we're mainly through that at this point. You know, the next step is going to be, we need to come up with ways to give our sponsors value for the next couple of months, creative ways, you know, storytelling of what the rider's life is like at home and what are they doing for workouts when they're at home. And, you know, I think it's our responsibility as a team to help keep people's morale up. to give them something to aspire for. Like, we're, you know, if we as a team, we're still working toward a Tour de France, and okay, maybe the Tour de France is in August and it's 10 days long, or maybe it's not until 2021, but whatever, you know, we're working toward the objective of, you know, racing the Tour de France, and we have to take that day by day, and this is how we're taking it day by day, and this is what our athletes are doing. I mean, it's our job to create inspirational stories. It's our job to show something of value and interest to our fans. And it's, you know, I mean, and it's our value to create, or it's our, well, we need to create value for our sponsors. So those are the discussions going on right now. Is like, okay, how do we do this? How do we inspire our fan base? How do we create value for our sponsors? How do we do something, you know, that helps, the broader world? You know, what is our part in this? Like, how can we make this better for cycling fans, for the people that are interested in our team, our fans, our, you know, how can we make this better for EF? How can we make this better, you know, for the cycling community in general? So those are what we're going to, and I don't have to answer to any of those questions right now. But those are the discussions that we're having every day, is like, okay, like, well, you know, what do we do to help?
Well, some interesting thoughts from Jonathan Vaughters there, even if he, like all of us, really doesn't have any answers at the moment. These are the questions I guess we're going to be asking, and they will become clearer, the answer to these questions, a little bit as we go down the road. But at the moment, I think it's probably best for all of us just to accept that the sport is going to need to be rebuilt in a way that preserves the best things about it, but also protects you know, some of the more vulnerable. I mean, there will inevitably be some teams and races that don't survive this, I'm sure. I mean, I just don't see how, looking at the sort of economic impact across the board, I don't see how some of the more vulnerable and some of the more exposed companies will get through in quite the same shape. But it's, I think, as I said before, and I won't repeat myself week in, week out, but hopefully everyone from the UCI to the race organisers, to the teams, to the broadcasters, will be able to put their heads together, perhaps put aside some of their competing interests and think of the best way forward collectively. But that, of course, is for months down the line.
Yes, I mean, we will obviously be covering this story as it unfolds, but looking at different aspects of it too and how it might affect pro cycling over the coming weeks. We mentioned last week that we would be continuing with our daily Giro coverage. Giro won't be going on in its usual slot, but we will be producing daily episodes, a twist on the Giro, and we've got some, I think, exciting plans for what, you know, the slot that would have been the Giro's time in the calendar. So stay tuned for more details on that.
You're going to ride the route, aren't you, in real time, the same number of kilometres on a turbo trainer. I think you agreed that. That's definitely, that's locked off and agreed, signed off.
Uh-huh.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry.
When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.